They say plants like music.
Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
MSW Media.
Today, Professor Christine Blasey Ford testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and gave a powerful and emotionally gripping account of her attempted rape by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh was defiant, taking on an angry, partisan tone that was unprecedented for a Supreme Court nominee. Kavanaugh and the Republicans attacked the process and all of the allegations against Kavanaugh as part of a partisan scheme. So what are the implications of today's testimony on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh and on how sexual assault victims are treated in the future? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name is Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a CNN legal analyst. And I'm joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, a comedian and WGN radio host who will join us regularly on this podcast. So, Patty, we literally are moments away from the conclusion of the testimony today. How are you feeling about today?
This was a wild day, and I want to say that for anyone who follows me on Twitter, because you're gracious enough to retweet some of my comments, this was a very long day, and I am, as you mentioned in my introduction, I'm a stand-up comic, and one of the reasons I'm a comic is because I process the world through humor. So anybody who maybe gets upset that this is not a laughing matter, part of what I do is to try to take things that are sometimes painful and sort of reflect them in a way that I can really get through it. And today was a really long day. But I thought that they were both compelling. I'll be honest with you, as much as it was sort of jarring when Kavanaugh was yelling and crying and a lot of different things, I felt as though he is connecting with the people he needs to. But I really identified so much with Professor Blasey Ford because that was hard for her to come forward. And I tweeted this out earlier today, and we can talk about this later if you want. But I myself am a survivor, and this is not something I would wish on anybody in any situation, to be in front of millions of people. And okay, so let's just get to it, right? The idea that there was a prosecutor who was questioning Professor Blasey Ford in lieu of the GOP Judiciary Committee providing questions, right? Rather than having their 5 minutes, it was the prosecutor. She's from Arizona. And there was something weird about, I honestly going into this thought that she would be a little more sort of trying to draw out information from her. But it seemed like she had an agenda too. It was all about, were you paid by the Democrats to be here today? That was all of what her line of questioning seemed to be. Am I wrong about that?
You know, what I would say, and I'm going to try to be charitable for her, is I felt that the prosecutor was put in a very difficult position for a couple of reasons. First of all, there really had not been a complete investigation prior to this point. So usually she would have a lot more information to work off of, first of all. Second of all, she would not be in a situation where her time would be broken up into 5-minute increments.
Oh, that was so disorienting.
Well, for sure. And I think really it reflected the problem of this entire process. So, you know, this hearing took all day long. I know you and I watched it from beginning to end. I took the day off work, and I'm sure you must have as well. And despite all that, it's very hard to get at the truth when each person has 5 minutes to ask a question. And sometimes, you know, this was more true for Kavanaugh than for Blasey Ford. The witness is going on and trying to run out the clock at times, right? So for her, you know, it's hard when you're trying to build a line of questioning to do that when you suddenly have to give up the floor to another person. I think that was working against her. And I think another problem was, she was given too much time. And what I mean by that is, for Professor Blase Ford, I really don't think she had a lot to work with. So if a young lawyer was coming to me and they said, I'm going to be defending this case of attempted rape, and I'm going to have to question the victim, this woman, Dr. Blase Ford, I would tell that person, let's ask five questions and then sit down. There isn't enough to work with her, because no one's going to be able to contradict her, really, other than Judge Kavanaugh. Judge isn't there. Kavanaugh, okay, he's going to testify later. And there's not enough stuff around the periphery that we know about that's really going to hit, you know, kind of do some damage to her. Jury's not going to like it if you beat up on her too much and on peripheral issues. So ask her about what I'll call the limits of her knowledge, things that she doesn't know about. Like, you don't know this, you don't remember that, you can't say this, you didn't see that or whatever, and then sit down. And do it in a very polite way. But she couldn't do that because she had an hour to fill. So she had to, I think, spend a lot of time asking a lot of tangential stuff.
Right, about, you know, how are you paying for your defense team? How are you paying for the polygraph? How are you paying for all these different things? And, you know, it seemed as though she was trying to get her to say, well, the Democrats approached me and wanted me to do all these different things, is what it sounded like, because later in the day, Kavanaugh seemed to be saying that was really what had happened, that they had funded all of this, they had created this all of thin air, which was weird, because everyone, the GOP was trying to straddle this line of, you know, we really sympathize with you, Professor Blase Ford, but at the same time, you know, really going after the Democrats, as though it was just so bizarre. And the way they treated each other, I could not believe that Senator Grassley interrupted Dianne Feinstein within moments of her beginning to speak.
Well,
it was so bizarre.
There was a lot of interrupting and rude behavior. I have to say, just to kind of back up for a minute, because I suspect not everyone has watched.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Let's let people kind of.
The last 10 hours.
The 9 hours of information that we have is not shared by everyone.
Exactly. So let's start with if I'm going to kind of do a broad takeaway here. I mean, my first takeaway is, you know, there was almost like two separate hearings here, and there were technically two separate witnesses, but the feel of them both were so different, right? The first hearing, you had a woman give very emotional testimony. She wanted to be helpful, very respectful, would sit and listen intently to every question and try her very best to answer it. And she was being questioned on one side by a professional prosecutor who was asking her questions, you know, at times to try to develop lines of cross-examination, at times just to gather facts. And then on the other side, there was sort of a mixture, I'd say, of supportive statements in some factual questions that were being asked on the Democrat side. On the second half of the hearing, we had Judge Kavanaugh come out with just a very angry performance. And it was very jarring to me because, you know, if you remember, Patty, we did a podcast a few weeks ago with Neil Katyal. And I remember at the time I thought Kavanaugh was a shoo-in. And I remember me and Neil, who both went to Yale Law School, we were both, I think, maybe a few years behind Judge Kavanaugh. But we both said, look, this guy's a very professional guy, very distinguished fellow. We disagree with his outcomes. We think that he's somebody who's going to take away people's rights in various ways, but very, very reserved, judicial sort of fellow. And we did not see that today, right?
What did you see today?
Right. Now, I
that was frightening.
I will say during that podcast, I talked about how I thought he was a Republican operative. He had worked on all, you know, for Bush versus Gore, and he had worked on Ken Starr and all
these.
Didn't
he leak info to the grand jury as part of Ken Starr's team?
He leaked info from Ken Starr's investigation to the press, for sure.
Smear Clinton publicly.
Yeah, or at least to get messages out that they thought were helpful, I would say. You know, he was certainly a very partisan guy, and I described him as somebody who I thought had been sort of a Republican operative his whole life. But I didn't think that Kavanaugh would ever show that in public in this way. And what we saw here was, from his opening statement throughout his entire questioning, him being an overt partisan, attacking Democrats as a Clinton smear campaign against him sort of thing, and going after the Democratic senators personally, being very rude and acerbic towards them.
When he was asked about, you know, have you ever been blackout drunk? And he would say, where have you? Okay. Mm-hmm. Answer the question.
Yeah. I mean, he would ask them questions about, you know, he would mock their questions about his activities in high school and college, which are only relevant because he's accused by fairly credible allegations of sexual assault in high school and college. So I think, he took on sort of the tone that I would expect a commentator on Fox News to take, as opposed to a nominee for the United States Supreme Court. And it really, to me, was a shocking shift. So to me, you know, we were talking a moment ago about the prosecutor in the first half of it, and that's one of the more interesting pieces of drama from...
Yeah, where'd she go?
Right, well, and then she disappeared in the second half, right? She didn't... What happened was she started asking questions to Kavanaugh and I think was gathering information and locking him in on some points, and then Lindsey Graham stepped in and came in with a very blistering attack on Democrats in the process that echoed what Kavanaugh said in his opening statement. So as a broad takeaway, you know, one thing that I really saw from this hearing was that despite all of this, you know, going into this hearing, we saw not only obviously this allegation by Professor Blasey Ford, which we discussed in the last podcast, but also there's allegations from two other women who've come forward. Deborah Ramirez, who made an allegation about sexual assault by Brett Kavanaugh when he was a student at Yale, as well as a woman who came forward just the day before the hearing with very disturbing allegations about men, you know, essentially Brett Kavanaugh, you know, being involved in a train of men who were taking turns having sex with a woman without her consent, right? I mean, I think is maybe a good way of putting it. And so very explosive allegations. And, you know, after Blasey Ford's testimony, which I think everyone thought was credible, even the Republicans, you know, it looked like Brett Kavanaugh was in a bad position. And then we saw, I think, a very dramatic shift.
Right. And I think it set the tone. And I think, I mean, he kind of needed to do that to follow. If you're going to follow, you may as well go in. You may as well go big or go home. It seemed as though that was the tack they chose.
Well, for sure. I think he was in a very bad spot at that point. You know, he had just had somebody accuse him of attempted rape in a very credible way, and in a way that elicited, I think, a lot of sympathy from everyone. I mean, how could you not feel bad for the woman listening to her?
But I think a lot of people responded to his reaction in a way that, yeah, of course he's going to feel that way. He's, you know, desperate to save his career. He wants the limelight off of his family. You know, a lot of people tweeting, especially, you know, men who are saying, you know, if this was me, I would be that upset. I would be outraged. Yeah, I think for some people that was really compelling, that he was basically fighting for his life in front of us.
You know, it's interesting. If I was preparing him as a witness, I would have told him, look, you need to have a certain level of indignation. You have to push back to a certain level, and you need to be upset and talk about the pain for your family. But you should always come off as in control and judicious, not angry, not unhinged in any way, because you don't want to play into these allegations that at times you can lose your temper and get angry. And that clearly he did not follow that playbook, and it seems to have worked for him. Republicans liked the fact that he just went all hyperpartisan and very on the offense and was very aggressive. So, you know, it's interesting to me. Well, certainly we could talk later, I guess, or we could talk at some point about what this means for this nomination, but I wonder what this means for the next nominee. I mean, are we going to have this every time now?
Some of the senators, I believe Lindsey Graham was one of the senators who said, you know, if this is where we're going to do this, you know, be ready for this. I mean, he basically threatened everybody, saying, okay, if this is a game we're going to play, then the gloves are off. But I felt like there weren't really any gloves for a while, it seemed. And to everybody who says that this was conjured by the Democrats out of thin air, why would it be Kavanaugh and not Gorsuch? Why has this never happened before? If women lie, that's been a big thing, you know, that people are saying that, you know, these women are just trying to get attention. They want to make money. They want to sell books. Then why has it never happened before on the scale?
Yeah, I will say that. It's if somebody who was a local judge or county commissioner had three women who didn't know each other come forward and say that that man had committed sexual assault, we would have a very serious, unbiased, professional investigation. And he would probably be suspended, in during the pendency of that pending the outcome of that investigation, and these other anonymous allegations, there would be an effort made to try to find more information about them, to put calls out to other people. And what we've seen in other circumstances are the numbers grow. I mean, no one thought in the beginning, I think, that Bill Cosby was raping dozens of women. If you told somebody 10 years ago that Bill Cosby raped 60 women, I don't think that anyone would have believed you. But the numbers grow over time. We've seen this with whether it's Weinstein or Cosby. Sometimes the numbers can grow. You would at least expect an investigation so that those allegations can be explored and others can come forward if there was anything. Here, what we're seeing is the exact opposite. Shut it down. Get this done. Get the vote in. I mean, there's a real effort now, I think, to get this vote done this weekend.
Well, what do you think it means for future nominees? And I guess we should say what happens next, because CNN is now just reporting that that Collins, Murkowski, Flake, and there's about four or five that are meeting that might be the deciding votes if they decide to hold it tomorrow.
Well, there's no question that the whole power here is held by a few senators. And this is because the filibuster was removed. And part of the, what happened there was essentially the Republicans were obstructing President Obama's nominees. So the Democrats are like, forget it. We're going to get rid of the filibuster for non-Supreme Court nominees. And then the Republicans for Gorsuch said, no, we're going to get rid of it for the Supreme Court, right? So, I guess what I would just say is I think we can expect a lot of 51-49 and 52-48 votes for Supreme Court justices in the future. It seems to me that being hyper-partisan as a judge is now going to be overtly partisan, is going to become more of the norm. And that's because unless Kavanaugh goes down in flames, if he goes down in flames, then maybe the lesson will be, okay, if you do that, that's not going to work for you. But assuming, let's just say for the moment that Kavanaugh makes it through, I mean, I think the lesson is if you're on the Republican side, don't be ashamed of how conservative you are and what you're going to do. I mean, you don't talk about specific cases, but be like, yeah, I'm a Republican, I'm a partisan, screw the Democrats, et cetera. I mean, one thing that I wonder is, Judge Kavanaugh is supposed to be neutral and supposed to be, not impugn the impartiality of the judiciary. And I wonder if, for example, the Democratic National Committee had a case in front of him.
He'd be punitive, I think.
Could he be partisan?
Yeah.
Nonpartisan? Could he be impartial? It certainly harms the reputation of the judiciary. We've had, over the last years, partisan, the country's become more partisan, more radical, less cooperative. And that's happened in the Senate. That's happened in the House. That's happened in every, you see it in our, even just in local government, our institutions. And now certainly the Supreme Court's been political for a while. Bush versus Gore is an obvious example. But this really, if we start having justices confirmed in this manner, the Supreme Court will look much more like a political body in 10, 20, 30 years.
If they do confirm him tomorrow, there are people who are wondering, can he be impeached later?
He can.
Because they could investigate and, confirm or negate any of the testimony he gave.
No question. So what will happen is you can imagine some of these accusers, and I don't even like the word accuser, but I'd say, let's say alleged victim, they can go and they could try to press charges. For example, in Maryland, that's possible.
Because there's no statute of limitations.
Right. But also, Jerry Nadler, who's the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, said that he would investigate. And the House, if the Dems take control of the House, he'll be the chairman. And then he'll conduct an investigation. And a majority in the House can impeach. Now, you'll need two-thirds of the Senate to convict. Presumably, if Kavanaugh gets 50%, now he's not going to be able to, you wouldn't be able to muster two-thirds against him unless the allegations get much worse. But it's just going to create a real pall over the Supreme Court. We already had a lot of, hurt, more, I'd say more than hurt feelings, anger and resentment over the way in which the Republicans kept a seat open for almost an entire year in order to ensure that Trump would be able to select In this case, Gorsuch, instead of the selection of Merrick Garland by President Obama. And now if we have somebody who's on the court who has multiple credible allegations of sexual assault and the Republicans push him through without fully vetting those instances, I can't imagine the message that sends for women. I wonder what you feel like the message it sends is.
Well, obviously the biggest thing that comes out in this situation has been, why did she wait so long? And I mean, I don't know if you saw, at the same time as I was watching the hearings, I was reading a lot of stories about women who were, there was a woman from a retirement home. She's 74 years old and never told her family. There were women calling into WGN radio and telling our hosts that they had, the one woman told John Williams that he was the first person that she was telling directly. And she was basically telling the whole audience because that's how affected she was by today's testimony. And one of the things that I tweeted out, because I was sexually assaulted when I was both 4 years old and when I was 15. And I told my mom I was going to become public with it. I was going to share this on Twitter. And I said, Mommy, why didn't we go to the police? Because my mom knew about it when I was 15. And she basically told me that because they weren't able to help us when I was four, that she just didn't think that we should have to go through that again when I was 15. And then she felt that it would be humiliating, that when I was four it had been so hard, that she just wanted me to try to move past it. And I think that's how a lot of people have dealt with it before. And that's the one thing I hope changes, is that we are helping survivors find their best way of connecting with whatever their truth is. And that doesn't mean you have to come forward. It doesn't mean you need to press charges, whatever way you need to deal with it. And to not have that huge wall of screaming voices accusing, you were drunk, or you don't remember, or gaslighting women or survivors in general. Because I know that when we talk about this, I hate to make it only about women, because I know survivors who were who are men. So this is I hope that the positive that comes from this is the support, knowing that there are others. And I've had friends of mine who've reached out. There were friends of mine from grade school who said that they had been raped in college and in high school and never told anybody. So I think that knowing that your truth is important, I hope, is the thing that shines through this.
If you want to look at it in an optimistic way, from an optimistic lens, I would say certainly there's been some movement. When you compare what happened in 1991, last week we were talking to, obviously, participant in that hearing back in 1991, how things were then versus how they are today. You certainly saw the Republicans at least paying lip service to the idea that Professor Blasey Ford deserved to be heard, that her allegations were important to listen to, that they had some sympathy for her and felt bad for her. They did not dismiss her as not credible. And they realized the optics of having them question all, older white men questioning her was not going to be good. And so they decided to have a woman handle that questioning. And regardless of how you feel about that decision, I think one thing you could take from it is at least they were sensitive to the appearance of how this would appear to women. On the other side, on the flip side, if Professor Ford's allegations are not further investigated, if the allegations of the other two women are not investigated any further, or investigated really much at all, I worry that the message it's going to send to women is that if the man you're accusing is powerful enough, it doesn't matter. I was watching CNN during this hearing. That's where I watched it. And Jeffrey Toobin's takeaway, my colleague there, was that women always lose. Women always get screwed. And I thought, that's not what I would have said if I was. You guys are hearing what I would say, but I thought it was a sad. It's a sad takeaway, and it's something that I don't want women to have as a takeaway, because I want women who are victimized to come forward.
I think that in some ways we just kind of live with that part of it, that we're, whether we're survivors or getting through other situations, that we're going to get the short end of the stick, and we're trying to move closer to, having the sort of access to justice that we deserve, whatever form that takes. But I think that if he gets confirmed, not only will it seem as though it just didn't matter that she had was kind of gone through the ringer, had her life threatened, had to move her family, really under the microscope on a global scale. People kept talking about nationally, but I'm sure this was international. People want to, we're a circus now. We are sort of this freak show in the United States, and this was all part of it. And it was unfortunate that it had to come to this, that they couldn't figure out a different way to handle it. I'm glad that she came forward. I think that it does need further investigation. They're not going to. But I hope that more survivors feel that some empowerment from watching her bravery today.
Well, for sure. And I think a lot of women already do feel inspired. I mean, I know some women who were there in the room who were there to support her and made that known. And I will say I thought she did an amazing job in there. She was, I've prepared many witnesses for testimony. I put many witnesses on the stand. She was an excellent witness. And there was such an authenticity to her account that I don't think anyone who is at all fair-minded could listen to her testimony and not be moved by it. Not just find her credible, but be moved by it and feel bad for her and for what she had gone through.
Wow. You weren't on my social media thread. There were a lot of people who just didn't like her look, the way her voice sounded. She sounds, I mean, it's hard, but I mean, this is part of it.
I said fair-minded. Yeah.
I know.
I think, you know, the one thing that is unfortunate about, you know, where we're at as a country right now is that there are some people who, you know, if someone said the sky, you know, and the other party said the sky was blue, they would look up to make sure that that was the case. You know, I think, you know, it's unfortunate that we're at that point, but I thought she came off as very credible. And I do think that even regardless of where this goes, you know, as we talked about, it's possible that these allegations are going to be further investigated.
I hope so. I think most people do.
I think
fair-minded people, as you said.
There you go. I think they will. And I think it will be an interesting thing for the court if he does make it on. Of course, there's a possibility that he does not. I mean, one thing that I will say is, you know, Senator Murkowski has at times signaled that, you know, she was concerned about these allegations in a way that was more than mere rhetoric. At times she did suggest a call for an FBI investigation, although she walked that back later. But she did talk about the importance of listening to victims and concern about the allegations. Collins apparently suggested the same in public, or excuse me, in private. But, you know, what they told Collins was interesting because she asked about subpoenaing Judge. And that was very interesting. So Mark Judge, is, of course, the other individual in the room with Kavanaugh and Ford during that incident, at least according to Professor Plassey Ford. And the Republicans did not subpoena him. He did not give a statement. And this is an important point because there was some misinformation.
Yeah, I was wondering about this because Kavanaugh kept talking about how he had made the statements and they were, you know, punishable by, you know,
felony
if he was lying. And what were those statements who were they to?
That's false, actually. That was very misleading by Judge Kavanaugh because what happened was is that Judge did not himself make a statement to the Senate committee. If Judge got on the phone with the Senate committee and made a statement to them, if he lied, that would be punishable by a felony. But what happened was his attorney submitted a statement, very carefully crafted 6-sentence statement that was a kind of a blanket denial. And the reason, and I know as somebody who now represents clients, the reason that the attorney makes the statement when somebody has potential liability is so that the words can't be put in the mouth of their client. So if there is something false in that testimony, the lawyer can say, well, that was just me. I was making that statement. You can't really attribute it to him. You can't pierce the attorney-client privilege to find out their conversations. And so that's the whole point of that. So, of course, there'd be a great value in subpoenaing Mark Judge to testify, even if he came just under oath to repeat those 6 sentences. And by the way, he might take the 5th, and that I speculate if I had to guess why they don't want Mark Judge subpoenaed to testify, I think it's because he would take the 5th, and then that would really throw everyone for a loop as to what if the other guy in the room takes the fifth, what does that mean? But another possibility, of course, is that he'd face very withering questioning and would not perform well when questioned. And certainly he is a very interesting character who's written these books that came out during the hearing about being blackout drunk and his various drunken adventures and so forth.
Yeah, no, I think that everyone would like to see Mark. That was my hashtag call Mark Judge.
Well, you know, it's funny. You said everyone wants to see Mark Judge. Clearly Brett Kavanaugh does not.
No, he does not. And he also doesn't want to say yes or no to whether or not the FBI should investigate him.
Correct.
That was interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, that was an interesting thing that happened during his testimony. And I think there he didn't want to cleanly say no because that clip would then be used on the news as a call, you know, as a, I think a mark against him, because it's something that I think everybody can get their heads around. And, you know, if you don't want the FBI to look into something, that probably means that you're worried about what they would find. So he essentially said no, but didn't say no.
Right.
And you know, one thing, though, I will say as a criticism of the Democrats is they realized that that was a good talking point. And they asked that same question
8 times, I think. 9, correct. Maybe, by the time they got to the
exactly
Mueller.
Right. And given they only had 5 minutes each, and they could have been way more economical. The only person who I thought was – the only two people I thought were very economical with their questions were Booker and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, to a lesser extent, Amy Klobuchar, very economical in their in the way that they use their time. And you have to be when you're given 5 minutes. And he was clearly running out the clock.
He was filling up that time with some BS. It was all about how his resume in college and all the great things he did and how good of a student he was and the sports he played and the volunteering hours. Okay, got it. Every single time you said it.
Right. Sorry. Well, that's, you know, you could see the difference between how Senator Harris asked questions versus some of the others. She's an experienced questioner. She has been a prosecutor in the past. And I think that he did not try to get away with as much with her. He did, of course, have a very nasty exchange with Senator Klobuchar, who was also a lawyer who's you know, conducted examinations in the past. But he ended up apologizing for that at one point.
Yeah. No, it was a crazy day. Historic. I mean, that's the other part of this. This is something we'll remember for a long time, whether or not he gets nominated and it gets confirmed. If he gets confirmed, though, I mean, his seat, just like Clarence Thomas, this is attached to him for the rest of his life, regardless.
Well, that's right. And, you know, Jeff Flake, he had 5 minutes. He only used one, and he used it to make a statement about how we'll never know and this and that. And that struck me as an indicator that he's voting yes. What I took from it is he was going to say, look, I'm voting yes because we can't ever know for sure. And we'll always have questions, but he's going to vote yes. That was my sense of it. But I could be wrong. But, you know, certainly there'll be questions. Now, for Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, that is not really interfered with his life much. I mean, I'm sure he's very upset about it, and obviously his wife is. There was an episode where she left an angry voicemail for someone. But what I mean is that, you know, he's on the Supreme Court. He has been for a long time. He lives his life, you know, he's a fairly anonymous guy and can live, you know, his life and goes to Federal Society conferences and does a lot of the things that he otherwise would do. You can imagine Brett Kavanaugh doing the same thing, being on the Supreme Court. It'd be hard to remove him. But he, in a way that Thomas was not, could be dogged by these allegations in a more serious way.
We shall see.
So, you know, one thing I am curious about, do you think, Patty, that this is going to have an impact on how we think of sexual assault as a country going forward?
I think that we're having a lot of conversations. I was appalled by how many people went to the boys will be boys, this happened 30 years ago, because there's a lot there, right? One, sort of dismissing women's bodies and saying that somehow men are entitled to it, whether they're teenagers or, you know, also our sort of psychological experiences and talking about what happened to us 30 years ago apparently shouldn't matter because it doesn't matter if those men did it. So we have no value in that sense. And also, what are we telling teenage boys? Are we telling them that if you do something now, it's okay because in 30 years it won't make any difference in your career? It devalues, I think, what it means to be able to be safe, really.
I think, you know, I will tell you, I had my mood went up and down during this. And I will say in the beginning, the way I looked at it was when Professor Blasey Ford was testifying, there were some real positives that were coming out of that for the country, aside from whether it was going to affect any votes for Kavanaugh, because you saw, for example, Chris Wallace on Fox News saying that his daughters came forward to him about sexual assault that they had experienced that he said was less serious, but he never knew about until that moment, and they had kept it from him for many, many years. And to me, having a wider audience recognize that sexual assault is pervasive, that it's often unreported for a long period of time, I think that's valuable for people to know. And regardless of what happened with Brett Kavanaugh, Professor Blasey Ford coming forward had that positive impact. But by the end, seeing sort of the defiance and anger, you know, I worry as if, you know, if the end game is, you know, you could imagine this of going in a more respectful way. For example, if that prosecutor had asked Kavanaugh questions, nothing much came out of it. You could imagine, you know, maybe they try to make some half-hearted attempt to judge, but at least it's a more, you know, more dignified ending to it. The way that it ended in such a defiant and angry and partisan tone makes me worry about what, you know, what's to come as a country.
And so much of it was she was confused. Basically, she mixed me up with somebody else. I'm sure she was attacked, but it wasn't me, kind of a thing, which also she seemed very specific. She seemed very clear. And you know, didn't seem at all confused about what had happened to her and by whom.
Well, for sure. She's a professor of psychology and kind of cited essentially or in referred to research about how trauma, victims of trauma do, you know, have very distinct memories. Certainly he was someone that she knew. But, you know, I think, Patty, that what they did and that this was fairly clever was alluded to what you just said. But they didn't say it.
Right.
In other words, you know, he didn't, Brett Kavanaugh didn't
come out.
But we
heard it that way. Believe me. We heard it that
way. That was the way it was supposed to be heard, right? It was the less accusatory way. So, Batty, what do you think this ends up meaning for the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh? Obviously, neither of you or I are Republican senators, but what do you think?
Oh, I think he goes in. I think that they'll confirm him tomorrow, and we'll have to go from there. And people make these comments all the time. This is why elections matter. This is why, you know, this is his privilege. The president has the right to nominate somebody who will reflect the agenda that he has, and this is where we are. And who knew it was going to reflect him so closely in somebody who has all these sexual allegations against them?
I think, you know, it certainly comes down to, you know, in terms of my view on it, and it's funny, by the way, I've gone back and forth, because I think the first time we discussed this, I thought Kavanaugh was going to sail through. And then the last time, I wasn't so sure, a week ago. You know, now I think I agree with you. It really comes down to that small group. If I had a bet, I would say that Pence was going to break a tie, that there'd be one Republican who'd defect, probably Murkowski, but that you would see the Republicans, you know, hold firm and confirm Kavanaugh by the barest of majorities. And that's what I would expect, and I expect it to happen in the near future. But who knows? There may be more twists and turns. There may be there could be another woman who comes forward. There could be more news that breaks. This is a very fluid situation.
Really, you think that more could come? I mean, I kept thinking, is there going to be another woman that comes forward, or will there be friends? I mean, the hard part, for a week or so, what was it, about a week and a half, where she was the sole person standing there saying, this happened to me, and then, you know, other women came forward. Do you really think there might? I mean, I guess. I don't know if today helps or hurts anybody else who wants to come forward. I hope that it helps if there's somebody out there who has this that they need to get out there.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, my concerns and thoughts have been primarily, as you could tell, on sort of the broader things that this means for our country, for women more broadly, for the future. Because, look, the stakes are very high with Brett Kavanaugh. We've discussed that at length in terms of the outcomes. But I do think it's hard to believe that there are bigger things at stake, but there are,
right?
At least in my mind. But it seems to me that you could imagine all sorts of, you know, maybe somebody comes forward who's a witness to one of these. Maybe somebody else comes forward who is a victim or alleged victim or not. At this point, I don't know if more, you know, from the way the Republicans are spinning it, and it's an odd argument, that the more people accusing you of sexual assault, the more sign that is that it's a conspiracy and not that the women can't be believed. It's a very odd argument from my perspective, but that appears to be. So maybe it won't have an impact. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I hope that I struggle with this because obviously this has been a really long day, first of all, a lot of testimony and emotions, and not just from the people that were in the courtroom, but across the country. You know, a lot of people outraged that were even, you know, trotting people out and going through the motions of this, but a lot of people who want to know more. I mean, I really believe that it's important to talk to the other witnesses, the other people that she has named, and I don't know why we can't hear from them, but that's neither here nor there. It does seem as though the long-term picture for America is, as you mentioned before, that, you know, if a woman comes forward, it might not matter if she's honest and telling the truth.
Yeah.
Not that I know for sure that Professor Ford is, but we're not getting. Okay, that was the part that bothered me the most, was the whole idea about the FBI and waving around the idea that Joe Biden had said during the Clarence Thomas hearings that the FBI doesn't make decisions. And I don't know if Joe Biden wants to take that back or not, or say that he was wrong, but they follow up on evidence and witnesses, and they, you know, they confirm or negate what's out there. That's my understanding anyway.
That's right. I mean, What Joe Biden said was essentially the fact that there was an FBI investigation of the allegations against Clarence Thomas does not mean that, you know, this issue has already been decided by the FBI. And I think that's all he was trying to say, because the FBI wasn't able to really corroborate Professor Hill's account or something along those lines, is my understanding, based solely upon that comment. I don't know any of the underlying evidence. But, you know, what the FBI does, as you point out, is they conduct interviews, they subpoena documents, they interview witnesses, they'll go out and verify facts. You know, there were facts that came up today of when Mark Judge worked at a certain store, Safeway, for example.
Right.
You know, that's the sort of thing the FBI is very good at, locating people, interviewing them, pinning down key facts. So they would just have, in a very nonpartisan and professional way, they're obviously professional, trained, experienced investigators, they would conduct an impartial investigation. And, you know, two questions that I've asked for a while that we'll never really know the answer to probably is, why not have an FBI investigation?
Right.
Why not subpoena Judge? I've speculated as to why they may not want Judge in there. He may take the Fifth. With the FBI investigation, they might just be worried about a week or two delay or what it could find. I really don't know. But I will tell you, I mean, a couple things that really I thought have always been tactical surprises for me, for the Republicans, is, you know, first was why they didn't do at least a cursory FBI investigation, just to take the talking point away, if they're just for
right.
crass political purposes, take a week off and do it. I mean, we've spent a week debating when she was going to testify anyway, so why not just take that week to do it? And the other thing that I don't understand is early on why they didn't just pull Kavanaugh and switch to Barrett, for example, a female nominee, who, you know, and just, you know, from a political perspective, they would have a lot fewer women who are upset if that happened. And you'd think if they did it early enough and quietly enough, it wouldn't upset conservatives. But I don't know the psychology of conservatives. Perhaps that would upset them. They'd feel like this would be encouraging Democrats to use these tactics in the future.
Well, it's an ego thing too, isn't it? It's like, we're right about that. That's what it feels like from the president as well, that he wasn't going to pull him because his hubris is just too significant. You know, it's just, I don't know if that's a way to put it, but I don't think he wants to feel as though he made a wrong choice.
Well, I do think the stakes are extraordinarily high for Republicans. They care very much about flipping the Supreme Court and having these outcomes, Roe versus Wade overturned, assault weapons ban stricken, et cetera. And this is an outcome that could stick for 20 or 30 years. And so I do think it's important to them. They think that they might lose the Senate in 40-some days. So I get that, although with 40-some days to play with and what's called the lame duck period after that,
right.
I would have thought that they might have played a little bit with that schedule, but you know, clearly they were not comfortable doing that.
They want to do it. They just want to. What was the phrase? They want to plow this through.
But, you know, I will say one thing about the way that the hearing was set up is very much she received I would say he had the last word, which is always an advantage in court. You always want to be the one to go second. She requested that. That was denied. And I think that helped them here. I mean, he said that he did not watch her testimony, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. I certainly would have in his shoes. But maybe it would have gotten him out of his mode of what he was going to try to accomplish there. But I think that, you know, there's no question that they were able to sort of set the tone for kind of how this came out of it by having a chance to react. Whereas I think if the order was reversed and he went and denied everything in a very angry way,
right.
Then they huddled over lunch and then she came on and testified and we had this very composed,
right.
Emotional performance, we might have had a different reaction coming out of it.
How did you like Senator Kennedy's, he was the last one, I think, to speak for the day. He had Kathy said, look me in the eye. He asked him, do you believe in God? You know, and the whole look me in the eye and all these things. It was I thought it was the perfect wrap up for the Republicans. I thought.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's hard for me to tell exactly what they're thinking. I have to say it's a hard question for me to answer because I have examined so many witnesses and watched so many trials and participated.
Have you ever
so
said, look
trials.
Me in the eyes?
No.
Look me in the eyes and tell me the truth.
Because witnesses lie on a fair and, well, call. I wouldn't say they straight up lie, but they minimize things on
sure.
a pretty regular basis.
Oh, really? I think we all saw a little minimizing.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly I would have to say, you know, one of the more obvious ones was the Renata alumnus.
Oh, that was uncomfortable.
Well, you know, Kavanaugh was saying that this just meant they were friends or close acquaintances or something. And it's the implication is clearly that it was suggesting that she was a conquest of his in some way.
And she's come out and said how hurtful it is to know that her name was used that way in the yearbooks and his answer to what's a devil's triangle.
Yes.
Yeah, that was awkward because he said it was a drinking game.
Right.
Let's not get into, I mean, if people want to Google it, that's up to you. But, and then boofing, which he said was flatulence jokes, which it is not. Hmm. Again, everybody go ahead and Google that. We don't need
Google
to get into
that.
Any details.
We're not going
to
get into details here.
But it was more than minimizing. It was wrong. I mean, people, this is not even true.
Right. And in a very clunky way. I think it was Senator Blumenthal tried to get at that. He used the jury instruction. If somebody's wrong on one thing, you can find their testimony wrong overall. I don't know if
those are urban terms. Right. I understand. That's something you could, I guess, feasibly, you know, say that you made your own meaning at your school. Sure.
Yeah. Who knows? But in any event, I think witnesses often are not completely truthful. And if somebody's going to lie under oath, mm-hmm. they're certainly going to look me in the eye and say that, you know, under the penalty of their soul or whatever.
Whatever that was.
They're going to say that, too. So I'm just so cynical. But I'm also the guy who can't watch Law and Order or something like that without just shaking my head in disgust.
All right, Renato, what do you see coming and what should people expect in the weeks to come?
Well, as to Kavanaugh, I think we've already discussed. I think both of us see him being confirmed, although things are so fluid. Who the heck knows?
Right.
There next week, we're going to see a discussion between Trump and Rosenstein, which could result in Rosenstein getting fired. Certainly, Congress wants Trump to do that, but it doesn't look like he's ready to at this point, based on his comments. It'll be interesting to see. If there is any fallout from this hearing as well, whether there's, for example, someone files charges and there's a criminal investigation, that could lead up to the midterms, which are only weeks away. Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.
On On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.